Y'all look a little spread out to me, and because of that, I guess I need to stand up here. Otherwise, I'd probably bring the lectern down to the... Are you comfortable over on the side? You prefer to be there? Or... Okay, I'll just play ping pong here. Hey, that's a good move. Maybe we get all of you come over. We'll use these two sections, if you don't mind. Take a minute. I'm sorry if it's disturbing your equilibrium and your note-taking and all that, but it will make it a little easier, I think, for me. Is this portable enough for me to move down to the main floor? Just lift like this? It's a little heavy, isn't it? How about right here, and I'll stand here. Good, thanks. In this session, I want to talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ in relation to a problem for believing in God, and in particular, for believing in the God of Jesus Christ. And this is the problem of evil. In the session following this one, which will be in a different room and off the lobby over that direction, I'll be speaking on the resurrection again, but there I'll be talking about three reasons why people today do not believe in the resurrection of Jesus. You might be a little surprised at what some of the reasons are. I don't think you'll be surprised by everything, but that is a nice follow-up to what I'll be talking about here. But these are self-contained presentations, and you don't need to go to both to benefit from the individual ones. This session, then, is called Evil and the Resurrection, or Evil and the Resurrection of Jesus. And I think to begin, it's a good idea that we understand what the problem of evil is supposed to be, so that we can then see how the resurrection of Jesus Christ relates to that problem, not only as a contribution to our conception of the problem, but as a contribution to our resolution of the problem. So what is the problem of evil? Well, a lot of people have the intuition that if there is evil in the world, then either God does not exist, or if God does exist, then God is not omnipotent and omnibenevolent. So now I have to define some terms. As Christians, of course, we believe that God has many different properties. We call them the attributes of God. Of some of these properties we call communicable attributes, almost like they're communicable diseases. But all that means is that they're properties that we also can have, even though God has them. And then, of course, God has properties that we cannot have because they're unique to God's nature. These are called incommunicable or non-communicable attributes of God. This is how theologians speak. And among the incommunicable attributes of God are the omnis, his omnipotence, his omniscience, his omnipresence, and what I call his omnibenevolence. To speak of God's omnipotence is to say that God is unlimited in his power. Right? That anything God cannot do is not a limitation in power, but it's a limitation in logical possibility, is a one way to think about it. And so God has a kind of power that we cannot have. I heard a definition when I was in college that has always stuck with me, that omnipotence is a kind of power such that God is able, by the mere exercise of his will, to accomplish whatever he wills. That's really unlimited power. By the mere exercise of his will, God accomplishes whatever he wills. What would that be like for us? Right, you know, there are a lot of things you would like to do that don't get done, not because you don't want them to happen, but because you can't make them happen. But there's nothing like that for God, according to that definition of omnipotence. Now, that's not the only property, impressive property like that God has. God is also said to be omniscient. which is to say that God knows everything there is to know. The way I like to put it is in terms of propositions and their truth value. God knows the truth value of all propositions. Any proposition is either true or false. It is exactly one or the other. It is never both, and it is never neither. So for any given proposition, that proposition is either true or it is false, and God knows what it is in every case. But I don't, and neither do you. Now, this means that God has a lot of trivial knowledge. He knows, right, how many weaves of the loom it took to make this carpet. I don't know that, and I don't particularly care. I think if I knew things like that, it would prevent me from knowing other things that I care more about, right? My mind would be cluttered with things that I don't need to know. That would be inconvenient for me. God's ability to know all these things is not inconvenient for him. It's just something he knows. Nothing prevents him from knowing anything. And as I understand it, that includes everything that has happened, everything that is now happening, everything that will happen, and more. And you say, well, what more could there be? If God knows past, present, and future, what else is there? And there's more. There's more that God knows. There's stuff that God knows hasn't happened, isn't happening, and won't happen, but could happen. And he knows what would happen if what could happen did happen, even though it won't. In other words, God knows counterfactuals. Counterfactuals are simply things that are not going to happen. They're not factual, but they could be. Right? They are contrary to fact, and they are conditionals. So we might say, if such and such was contrary to fact, the case, well, then God knows what else would happen. Now, that's quite an impressive form of knowledge. It's not enough that he knows everything that ever happened, everything that is now happening, and everything that will happen, but he has to know counterfactuals too. All right? He's omniscient. And that includes counterfactuals of human freedom. So, that if, contrary to fact, I happen to be at home just now, and the weather, let's say, was Southern California, let's say it was even warmer than when I left, and it was in the 90s instead of the 80s, that maybe my pool was warm enough for me to do the backstroke in the pool. He knows whether if I happened to be home today, I would be doing the backstroke in my pool. Now, it's contrary to fact that I'm home. That's a counterfactual. But he knows what I would be doing if I was home. Of course, I'm not. And he knows what I would be doing even though I would be doing that as an exercise of free choice. Wow. Are you impressed? So God knows past, present, future, and all counterfactuals of human freedom in one simple act of knowing. He doesn't find these things out. He doesn't look for answers to questions and then find out what they are. He just knows. And that's what we call omniscience. Nice, convenient word for something pretty amazing and pretty complicated. Do you agree with that? All right, so God has omnipotence. He's omniscient. What else? Well, he's omnipresent, which is, you know, he's everywhere, but he's not anywhere physically. And in virtue of being a spirit, God's presence is unlimited. There is no place God's consciousness does not exist. You see, your consciousness is of your surroundings and what your surroundings can tell you about other things, and that happens to be wherever your body is, at least under current arrangements. So your consciousness goes where your body goes until you die. And then your consciousness goes where your body isn't. But that's for another time. Right now, right, here and now, where you are, there you are, body and soul. But God is not limited physically. He has no body. He is a spirit, and his consciousness is everywhere. And that can be either very comforting or it can be discomforting. If you read Psalm 139, you can understand how that can be true in both cases. You are intimately known. Everything you think, Everything you do, all that happens, is happening before his gaze, his awareness. And if that makes you uncomfortable, then you have to understand he also loves you and is merciful towards you and has a plan for you and will help you achieve what that is in your day. So he's omniscient. God's omnipotent, he's omnipresent, he's omniscient. I'm changing the order there, I realize. And he's omnibenevolent. What is benevolent? We don't use that word a lot, do we? Benevolent. I don't know about you, but I think when I think of the word benevolent, I think of royalty, right? A benevolent king. Someone who has riches, someone who has resources, and the means to dispense with those on my behalf and on behalf of my peers, to our benefit. He is my benefactor. Right? Not all kings are benevolent kings. You could be a malevolent king, where you're interested only in despotism and making life miserable for your subjects. A benevolent king is not like that. God is the king of the universe, and he is a benevolent king. He is omnibenevolent. He is intrinsically, essentially good. He cannot do evil because he would not do evil. And, of course, he has all the resources you could imagine and more to express his benevolence towards us. Now, if God is all these things, then we are bound to be puzzled by some things that happen in our experience. We call them evils. They come in the form of suffering in various sorts. There are evils of the natural kind, like we have with tsunamis and earthquakes, when people are caught up in natural disasters, lose their lives or lose their livelihoods, lose family. They suffer because of acts of nature. Mother Nature is doing what she does and it's causing us problems. And these are evils of a certain kind, we think, because evil states of affairs occur as a result of them. Bad things happen. But not all evils are like that. Some evils are non-natural in the sense that they are not caused in this natural way with the operation of the laws of nature and such, but they're things that we cause. They're things we do to each other. It is what used to be called man's inhumanity to man. And this is called moral evil because morally responsible human agents perpetrate evils against others who are morally significant, worthy of more, deserving of more. Now, what's puzzling is that there should be a God who is omnipotent and hence unlimited in resources, omnibenevolent and hence disposed towards us, his creatures, with goodwill in every conceivable way, and yet there would be evil in the world. This is puzzling. Now, I don't say that there's a contradiction here because I don't believe there is, but I agree there's a puzzle here. I think we have to agree to that. And this is behind the intuition that so many people have that somehow or other it just can't be possible that there should be a God who is omnipotent, omnibenevolent, while there's evil in the world. Why? Because, an omnipotent God would be able to prevent evil if he wanted to. And an omnibenevolent God would prevent evil, he would want to, if he could. Well, if he's got both the could and the would, then there shouldn't be evil, right? That's the simple idea behind it. Now, in past conferences, I've talked about that idea and the suggestion that this is a devastating problem for the rationality of belief in God. That because these are not logically compatible possibilities. God is omnipotent, God is omnibenevolent, and evil exists. Somehow it's irrational to believe in God as long as there's evil in the world, and of course there is, so it's irrational to believe in God. Either there is no God, or God is good but not omnipotent, or he is omnipotent but not essentially good. Boom. Christian God, gone. I'm not going to repeat what I had to say then, today about that problem. I think that problem goes away if we think about our resources for dealing with it. Now, some people who are atheists don't think that argument as such really works. There are other arguments that are more effective, even though in a certain sense they're weaker. You see, that argument is supposed to show that it is logically impossible for God to exist, because it follows logically from the existence of an omnipotent, omnibenevolent being that there would be no evil. But there is evil, so it's not logically possible. Right? If that argument works, it is utterly devastating. I mean, we don't even bother with questions about how Jesus could be the son of a God like that if there is no God like that. Or how the Bible could possibly be the word of a God like that if there is no possibility that there is such a God as that. So that sounds like it could be a serious threat, but it's not such a serious threat because these things are not logically incompatible. But I'll leave it for another time for you to explore that. So some who agree that that's not logically problematic have still said, but you know what? Evil is still some evidence that God does not exist, and here's why. You see, some of the things that happen to us that are really bad, bad things that happen to us, we could explain them. We could see why God might let them happen. It might be to punish us or to correct us. It might be to help mold us into more mature individuals. But there are some evils in the world that are so utterly horrendous that it seems like there is no justification God could possibly have for permitting them. You see, yes, God's permission of some evils, no problem. But there are other evils, actual evils, that seem to us to be utterly gratuitous. There's the key word, gratuitous. When is something gratuitous? Something is gratuitous when its occurrence or its existence serves no good purpose, no good end. Right? That's the way I'm using the term gratuitous. The reason why some evils can be considered acceptable within the framework of belief in God is because you can make sense of what good purposes permitting them might serve. But can you think of good purposes for permitting all the evils there are? You might say, well, look, what difference does it make how things seem to us? We are finite, we're creatures. Are we supposed to know what purposes God would have or could have for permitting even the worst things that happen? And I think you're right to wonder that. But even if you're wondering that, you still have the question, what should you believe? What should you believe? Right? You might say, I can't think of any reason why God would permit the worst things that happen. And all you have to do is read the newspaper, turn on the late night television. It always has to be late night television, doesn't it? Right? When you're getting ready to go to bed and have your peace at the end of the day, and then it's all shoot 'em up stuff. You know, these horrible things that happened. You know, and then how do you sleep at night? Right? But it doesn't require a lot of concentrated effort to figure out what cases of horrendous evil we're talking about. Think of terrorist acts. Think of the way children are abducted and treated, mutilated, die, tortured. Even from a human point of view, you can't understand how a person could do it. How could God permit it? You see, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. And we might say, well, look, God is God. He's omniscient. He's omnipotent. We're not going to know what his reasons are for permitting these things, but he could have good reasons. But you see, the response is going to be, but look, here's the problem. The problem is we still have to make a decision whether it's reasonable to believe in God, and all we've got to go on is our evidence, how things seem to us. That's what it is to have evidence. And our evidence suggests that there is no good reason. That's kind of how the argument works. You have to let the argument play itself out in its strongest form. And to find any sympathy for the argument at all, you've got to understand how evidence is functioning in the argument, how it's being construed. as how things seem to us. And that's a very plausible way to conceive of evidence. It seems to me not only that God does not have some morally sufficient reason for permitting this evil, it seems to me he could not. That's how it seems to me. And as long as that's how it seems to me, it is more reasonable for me to believe that he doesn't exist. All right? Well, that's got a certain kind of compelling quality to it. Now, there's a lot you can say in response. First thing to say, I think, is, well, just exactly why does it seem to you like God could not have a morally sufficient reason? Your evidence that God could not have a morally sufficient reason for permitting evil is that you can't think of one. That's your evidence. But you see, any reason to think that God is omnipotent and omniscient is a reason to think that there will be things that God could do and know that you wouldn't be able to think of. So you've also got some evidence that there would be things like that. And of course, it wouldn't be surprising if they were things you could think about but not solve. Any reason then to think of God as omnipotent and as omniscient will be reasons to think that your perspective will be limited and should not be construed as a criterion for what God could or could not do. So you've got, but then there you've got to have reason to believe in an omniscient, omnipotent God. And I think there is reason to believe in such a being. Again, another time, another topic. So that is a description of how the intuition that evil, suffering is problematic for belief in God shapes up in two different directions. One with a logical argument that it's impossible for God to exist. Another with an evidential argument that says, well, gratuitous evil or seemingly gratuitous evil makes it very unlikely that God exists. So my evidence suggests that he doesn't. I know it's possible that he does, but I have to go with my evidence, and so I believe he doesn't. That's how it works. Now, as it happens, when we respond to the problem of evil, it's tempting to respond with very general rejoinders, very general arguments that deal directly with the challenges and that do not make full use of the resources within Christianity specifically for responding to the problem. What do I mean? What I mean is that when we respond to this general problem regarding the existence of God, we don't think about Christianity when we try to answer the problem. We just think about what are our logical options here. And that's a good thing to do, and there are good things to say, and in fact, I think many of these things may well be good enough to be sufficient to put the problem of evil to rest as an intellectual challenge to belief in God. But you and I, if we're Christians, do not just believe in God, do we? And we don't just believe that God is omnipotent, and that God is omniscient, and that God is omnipresent, and that God is omnibenevolent. We believe all that and more. We believe all that and more about God, and one of the things we believe about God is that he is revealed in the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And we find out more about what God is like from his revelation in his Son. And of course, we believe that when Jewish and Islamic people who also believe in God don't believe those things. Now the question is, are there resources within our specific beliefs about God through Jesus that would help us say more in response to the problem of evil? And what I'm interested in today is about how the resources of Christianity could help us respond to the problem of so-called gratuitous evil. So-called. Remember, our evidence that there is gratuitous evil is that there is evil that is what I'll call inscrutable evil. Right? Evil that is inscrutable. What's inscrutable about evil when it is inscrutable? It's evil that is such, I have to repeat this a couple of times, I think, for you to get it in your notes. Inscrutable evil is evil that is such that if God was justified in permitting it, we don't know what that justification is. Inscrutable evil is such that if God was justified in permitting it, we don't know what that justification is. It is inscrutable. Notice, it is not necessarily gratuitous. It might be, it might not. But it's inscrutable. If it's not gratuitous, we can't figure out why not. That's what it means to be inscrutable. And that is our evidence that it's gratuitous. Since we can't unscrew the inscrutable, we just say, well, it must be gratuitous. And of course, if it's inscrutable, from our point of view, it might be gratuitous, but of course, it might not be gratuitous. You want me to repeat the definition of inscrutable evil? I thought you might. Inscrutable evil is evil that is such that if God was morally justified in permitting it, we don't know what that justification is. It's a conditional. If he's justified, we don't know what it is. It's a statement about us and our limitations. It leaves open the question, is there really gratuitous evil? But it's the reason why we are tempted to think there is. It's the only evidence we have that there is. But of course, it's possible that it isn't gratuitous. So I want to talk now about what God might think about what we call gratuitous evil. Wouldn't that be interesting? That's tricky because if we call it gratuitous because it's inscrutable, it might be hard to figure out what God thinks about it. you see my point? If we want to know what God thinks about what we call gratuitous evil, and the reason why we call it gratuitous evil is because it's inscrutable, then it's going to be pretty hard for us to figure out what God thinks about it. Unless he tells us. Unless he reveals. And you see, that's where we can appeal to the special revelation of God in Christ to try to get a perspective on God's view of what we call gratuitous evil. And that's why we don't want to limit our response to the problem of evil to what you can say without assuming the truth of Christianity. Let's see what believing in Jesus Christ and the truth of Christianity could add to the strength of our response to the problem of evil. By considering what God might have revealed to be his attitude towards suffering that we think is gratuitous. Are you with me? Do you understand what we're trying to do here? It's only if he sort of peels the tent door back away so that we can peer in that we can begin to get a sense of what his attitude toward inscrutable evil is. Because otherwise, what? It's just inscrutable. So we have to thank God, if he's done this for us, that he hasn't made it utterly inscrutable because he's given us a little glimpse. Now, what we can expect is that if he's done this for us, he may not have done it in a way that is utterly demystifying. In fact, what it might do is raise more questions than we started with. And I'm okay with that if he is. So let's see what happens. And I want to focus on a sequence of events that we associate with the Passion of Jesus Christ. In fact, I want to remind you of the movie that was called The Passion of Christ. How many of you saw the movie? Okay, almost everybody in the room. Maybe everybody did see it. I saw it twice. The first time, I forced myself, and I have chosen that word carefully, to see it all. The second time, I allowed myself, also carefully chosen language, to look away at certain moments. I had already seen what I didn't need to see again. It was awful. A lot of people said it was gratuitous. I mean, that's almost exactly the word they use, right? It was that kind of talk. It's like, why do you have to have all that gratuitous violence in there? Of course, these are people who just load their films with gratuitous violence when it doesn't serve any real purpose. Right, just shoot them up, bang, bang, cutthroat, ugly stuff. That's okay. Why? Because it's not trying to, it's not really sending a message. Well, that's gratuitous. But you see, now we've got a movie where you've got all this violence, but it's for something. There were people who watched the movie, didn't know the gospel. They watched the movie, they came out saying, why did that have to happen to him? That's how really compelling the movie was, and I think how accurate it was to the biblical portrayal, because that's the attitude we should have. Why did that have to happen to him? Do you see what happens? Is when we ponder it, we realize, we wince, and we think, this is not right. There's no justice here. This is wrong. If anything is gratuitous, this is gratuitous. And I think that if we were convinced that Jesus Christ was crucified and yet he was innocent, if that's all we believed, and we didn't believe in God, or we didn't know what to think about God, and we thought, wow, how could God allow that? And we had no answer to the question, we would think there was not a better case of gratuitous evil than that. That's what I think. I don't think you could come up with a better example of gratuitous evil than the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. I don't think anything in your own experience, as bad as it's been, anything that you've witnessed in the lives of other people or heard about on television, as bad as that's been, I don't think anything that happened on 9/11 is as gratuitous as the evil that occurred at Golgotha when Jesus Christ, an innocent man on trumped-up charges, was murdered. And brutally so, in a very public and humiliating way, after a farce of a trial, where all of the human representatives of justice in the world collaborated to act unjustly. The religious leaders, the political, the multitudes who went from wondering at his grandeur to mocking him and saying, crucify him. Right? Justice of the mob, justice of the religious elite, justice of Pilate and the political officials. The justice rendered by the crucifiers, the ones carrying the weapons of destruction of the body. I mean, these were men who, you know, they're trained killers. And of course, Jesus is just totally at their mercy. He's got no defenses. And yet they just take it out on him, right? And this is what they do with relish. They don't care whether it's just or not. They've been told to execute, and that's what they do. And we can imagine that some of them do it with relish. I get to do it again. This is what I do best. Now we know of one who was somehow struck by what he observed and could not quite make sense of how this man could suffer the way he did. And he remarked about it. He was himself a centurion. He had a lot of experience, but he never seen anything like this before. This was gratuitous, people, if anything ever was. And what I'm saying if God did not, and maybe he didn't, all right, this is a very temporary proviso, if God did not say anything to us at all about how this could be justified, we would be pretty well mystified, right? Now, we might not ultimately care that much. I mean, as sad as it is to say, that's 2,000 years ago, that's somebody else, different culture, right? We're much more civilized today, right? So, you know, unfortunate, but, you know, we still have to go on with life. That's fine. Take that attitude. But I challenge you to come up with a better example of would-be gratuitous evil if God did not tell us more about what it meant. It would look unjustified to the maximal degree. Now, if you add to that the idea that Jesus Christ was somehow God's son and he was here as a special messenger from God to reveal the kingdom of God, and that's all you knew about the message and about what God's reasons were for sending him, you might say, well, this is a kind of tragic ending. Why would it have to go like that? Right? What, are you going to send him into the world, he's going to preach this message, and he's going to die like that? Why would you treat somebody like that? You see, now it starts to look even worse and more horrendous and more utterly gratuitous. We want to know what gratuitous evil looks like to God for whom it isn't gratuitous, or what we think is gratuitous. We would like to know what God would say about what we think would be gratuitous evil. And I think to do that, we have to ask what God did say about what we would have thought was gratuitous if we never had heard what God said. And if he hadn't revealed himself, we wouldn't. We'd still be wondering. And right at the top of our list of gratuitous evils would be the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth 2,000 years ago. Now, I think that's a pretty deep thing, because without going further, I think you've already thought of what it is that explains God's permission of it. Right? You know. Not because you have good instincts. Not because there's something natural about it. But because you've read what God himself has revealed. And you understand that there was a very deep reason why this was permitted. This was planned for. This was arranged. You know, this is controversial, I think. I was going to say, if we did not have revelation from God, we just had a historical account of the crucifixion. Everything is exactly the way it happened, but no revelation of its purpose. We would maybe think, wow, that's just an incredible thing. And those guys, those people tortured him and killed him. And, you know, I mean, they just, you know, they took his life away. And we would be wrong, but we would think we were right. What was wrong? What's wrong with thinking that? Because the scriptures reveal that he gave up his spirit. And would we have known that even if we'd been standing there at the foot of the cross? This is what I think is controversial. Maybe not. What would our evidence be? Maybe something he said, maybe an expression on his face. The fact that he did say, "It is finished," whatever that means, without the benefit of revelation. Maybe it's that it's unusual for a crucified person, as horrible as crucifixion is, to die this soon, only 6 hours after he's dropped in the hole there and he's jarred and he's caused to suffer that. He's still gonna agonize for a couple of days, probably. That's the usual length of time. So you might think, now, if he died within 6 hours, something else was going on. Okay, you might think that, but you might not. And you wouldn't know what to think it meant if you were suspicious, unless God revealed it. The scriptures reveal that he gave up his spirit. It was an intentional act, and it was an act of a certain kind. You know, in philosophy, a field that I teach, though I don't teach in the field of action theory per se, we have a branch of philosophy that deals with action, what actions are, and what individuates an action, what makes an action of a certain kind. And you can't just go on outward appearances, especially when it comes to human action. You also have to understand intention. And part of what defines an action is the intention of an agent performing the action. So when Jesus gave up his spirit, you don't understand what the action is unless you know why he did it, what the intention is. So it's not enough to know that it was intentional. You've got to know what the intention was. What purpose did it serve? And of course, it did serve a purpose. He laid down his life for us. That's the language of the Bible. Now, would we have known that, just standing there at the foot of the cross thinking, gosh, it's awfully early for him to expire? No, we wouldn't. How would we know something like that? How would we know something like that? We would think it was gratuitous. Nothing more so than that. Now, I think the only way we could know what intentions Jesus had in giving up the Spirit as he did for us is if God revealed it. But what's interesting is the way he did, the way he revealed it. And how we are justified in believing that we understand God's actual reason for doing it. It's called the resurrection of Jesus. You see, when Jesus Christ rose from the dead, he had doubly conquered the grave. You see, he said, "Into thy hands I commit my spirit." And then he gave up his spirit to the Father. And he wasn't killed, but he gave his life up. So the grave didn't take him, he gave. And of course, in the grave, he preached to the spirits who were in prison. But that's another story. That raises questions. That was a victorious speech. That was a speech of victory. But then he rose from the dead, something we can know about, and conquered the grave in that sense. So, you see, if the man is good enough, you can't keep him down. But only Jesus is good enough. He's the reason why there's only been one who has risen from the dead. You can't keep a good man down. I think that's plausible. What does that say about us and everybody else who's died except Jesus? Well, we're definitely not good enough to warrant resurrection. But you know what? We are good enough from God's point of view to warrant crucifixion. Go figure. Good enough from God's point of view to be loved so much that he would give his only son. And so he would be crucified. And the selection of salvation, substitution, sacrifice, I think had to look gratuitous from our point of view without the benefit of revelation. It had to. Think about it. What happened in the Old Testament? The whole Hebrew system of sacrifice sacrificed what? What was the object of sacrifice? A little lamb. Little lamb, innocent as can be, minding his own business. Yeah, he wanders away every now and again. You bring him back. Just bleats, doesn't do any harm. Harmless, innocent, unblemished lamb. And it wasn't enough that the animal itself was innocent, but it had to be pure, it had to be specially preserved, its genetics had to be right, and it had to have the right appearance, right? And this thing gets sacrificed, repeatedly, ritually sacrificed as an emblem of what's going to happen. And I can only imagine how little girls or even little boys first felt the first time they observed something like that or heard about it. I thought, oh my gosh. You know, God requires that? Why? That's so, like, gratuitous. If they had the word gratuitous, that's what they would be saying. Doesn't it seem that way? So now we come to the resurrection of the Lamb of God who has given his own life. You see, here he is, innocent. He sacrifices. It's seemingly gratuitous, but we find out it's not. And the reason why we know it's not is because he was raised from the dead. That is an indication that God was pleased with his sacrifice. It accomplished something good. And when it accomplishes something good enough, it's not gratuitous. So now you have to ask yourself, was my salvation a good enough good to make his sacrifice less than gratuitous? Do you know how loved you are? Is accomplishing my salvation good enough of a good to justify that kind of sacrifice so that it's not as gratuitous as it would otherwise seem to us? I don't think we think often enough about how great a good that must be if that is justified. Now that, people, is a resource in our quiver for dealing with the problem of evil when people want to say, what about all the gratuitous evil in the world? You want to say, yeah, let's talk about that. Let's take a really good instance of it. Let's talk about the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And you know what? That would be gratuitous if there wasn't a God. But you know what? There might be a good reason why it was permitted. It might have even been planned for by God. And you know what Christians believe? That's exactly right. But we only believe it not because we could figure it out ourselves. We believe it because it was revealed by God. And our reason for believing it was revealed by God is because we've got reasons to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. Evil and the evidence for God. Evil and the resurrection of the Son of God is a really deep truth, something for us to think more about than we usually do. Now, there's one passage, I want to conclude with this, and then I want to give you a chance to just ask a couple questions. There's one passage in Philippians that adds to the richness of this that still leaves us wondering more. You know, we want to know more. And it's in Philippians chapter 3. Because it kind of brings things around full circle. Philippians 3, 2 verses, 10 and 11. Here's what it says in the English Standard Version. That I may know him, that's Jesus Christ, and the power of his resurrection, and may share in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead. I have a philosopher friend named Alvin Plantinga. He's one of the most best-known American philosophers living today. He's a Christian philosopher at the University of Notre Dame. Commenting on this passage, he asked this question, what is it that is valuable about fellowship and sharing in the sufferings of Christ? What's so good about that? We share in the sufferings of Christ, whatever that means, and in doing that, we experience fellowship with Jesus. What makes that such a good thing? And he proposes a couple of possibilities that are reflected to some degree in the text. And the first is that the deepest expression of God's mission in the world is found in the crucifixion and the resurrection. And when we can identify with his sufferings, we are in some almost mystical way identifying in solidarity with the mission of God in Christ in the world. In a way, you see, Jesus Christ affirms suffering because of some good that it can accomplish. And so that when we suffer, we can own that as part of our own vocation, joyfully participating in the suffering of Jesus Christ, because we know that no suffering is gratuitous, no suffering is wasted, because it is kind of wrapped up in the suffering of Christ. And that's how fellowship comes in. Fellowship comes in a kind of bond, a kind of unity, a kind of, we feel this solidarity with Jesus because we suffer too. And he showed us how. And he showed us what it could mean. And when we enter into that, it's like our suffering is also for some good. It's tied in. Can I explain it all together? I can't. There's mystery here. But you see, I can believe it because I understand a little bit of what it means to say the suffering of Christ, as gratuitous as it seems, is revealed not to be. And now my suffering puts me in touch with him as somehow in solidarity with him because I'm suffering too. The things that we suffer put us into a kind of relationship with him that joins in his purposeful suffering, even when we don't always understand what our own is. And then the second point that he makes is that in our own suffering, we come to resemble Jesus. You know, we're supposed to be like Christ. And, you know, we think that means living a holy life and so on, and being wise and discerning and humble and merciful and having his virtues and so forth. But it also includes his suffering. And you become more like Christ in virtue of suffering and entering into the fellowship of his sufferings through your own. That's part of what it is to come into his likeness. There's a great good there if you want that. It can be that way. So what I'm proposing this afternoon is that we shouldn't just limit ourselves to what we can say in response to the problem of evil without the benefit of revelation. I think we can say, but you see, we're Christians, and you are challenging us and our belief about God in Jesus Christ, so let us tell you what we think helps us understand better what God really thinks about what we call gratuitous evil. And we do that by going to the thing that from a human point of view is utterly gratuitous, but under the light of revelation is shown to be for some incredibly great good for which we can only be grateful and thankful because of the reflection of God's mercy that it is to us. All right. That's what I have to say. Do you have any questions or comments about anything that I have said in this session? Yes, Herta. Yes.
So in a way, I'm surprised sometimes that God puts up with us as long as he does.
Yes.
And so I don't have a problem as such, let's say, with evil. And I'm wondering, let's say like the tsunami that hit or Katrina, that this is just maybe like a little warning sign.
Mm-hmm.
The warnings before, God kind of gets louder and louder.
Yes. Well, no, I don't think you're on the wrong track at all, and it's probably been hard for all of you to hear what she said, but she was talking about how when we think theologically about our sin and our unworthiness, we're just so utterly at God's mercy, just in terms of our power, and we're utterly at his mercy in terms of our moral character, that I'm kind of paraphrasing, I guess, but she says, I don't really have a problem with evil and God allowing it because, I mean, who are we, right, in that kind of sense. But then she said, you know, there are, you know, events like tsunamis or whatever, natural disasters and things that may become more frequently or they, you know, they show up at certain times. And it might be partly because God's trying to get our attention and making it louder and louder that, you know, he's beckoning to us and we're unresponsive. Am I saying effectively what you had in mind? Now, C.S. Lewis said as much when he spoke of evil as God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world, right? That's quite an image. And you spoke of getting louder and louder and louder, right? And it's like that. I think that's all true. And I think that there are lots of things we can say in response. You know, why we might deserve certain things that happen to us. All I'm focusing on is just one little thing that we could be saying that we aren't saying very much. We haven't been saying that, you know, if critics of Christianity want to say, well, but you see, there are these inscrutable evils that are good reasons to think that there are these gratuitous evils. And if they're really gratuitous, well, then there's no God. And there's good reason. So we got good enough reason to think that there are such evils, good enough reason to think there's no God. I want to say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Let's talk about this idea of a gratuitous evil. Let's take one that is seemingly gratuitous without the benefit of revelation, because we have to bracket that. You are an atheist, after all. And see what that might look like if God had something to say about it. And you see, Christianity tells us the answer to that. Now, you don't have to buy it, but I think that what helps here is to say, look, now we can make sense of the idea that there are goods known only to God that justify permitting some evils that seem gratuitous to us, but might not seem so gratuitous if God showed us a little bit of what was going on. And in this case, he did, and then he gave us an additional reason to think that's really the reason by raising Jesus from the dead, something we can test historically. Yes? Well, that's a great question, if you don't mind me cutting in. There are people who will ask, you know, why does it have to be like that God saves us? You know, I made this point. I said, it says something about the great good of saving us that God should cause the suffering of Jesus. If it's not gratuitous, then there must have been something really great and good about achieving our salvation. But that assumes that was required and not something else, that some other way was not possible. That's an excellent question. Now, I would like to know who would stand up and propose a way that was better, that we could be sure was better. Now, we could be sure it was better if we had word from God that there were other alternatives. We're sort of lacking in alternatives that God has told us about. We might not be so lacking in alternatives that others have suggested. But how plausible are these up against what God is alleged to have actually done and probably did do, since we have good evidence for it, from the resurrection? You see? See, I think we have more reason to think there wasn't a better way because this is how God did it than to think that there is a better way because we can think of something that's more satisfying to us. And the reason why we think this is the way God did it is because we have such evidence as evidence for the existence of God, reason to believe in his goodness, and hence the expectation that he would only do good for a good purpose, and then also reason to believe historically that Jesus rose from the dead. Now, this is a kind of shortcut answer. We want to look at the details of a specific proposal. We can't do that right now. But my general response would simply be, first, but are we going to be more swayed by speculative possibilities that we can dream up or more swayed by what actually happened so far as the evidence suggests? And then the other thing I would say, which I haven't just said just yet, is that, you see, we don't really know how serious the sin problem is until we know what it takes to deal with it. And whenever we propose an alternative to that form of atonement, we presume to know what would be enough to deal with the problem. And that presumes to know how serious the problem is. But you see, I think one way to know how serious the problem is to see how serious the medicine is. And so I think that we would not take as seriously the problem of human sin and think it as big of a deal as it is if it wasn't for the cost that was apparently required in the form of the innocent blood of the Lamb of God. And I don't think we can trump God and provide a higher authority that would establish that he went further than he needed to. Those would be my two responses. One more, right here. Neil? Right.
Enoch, who apparently pleased God, and that's all we know about him.
Yes. He walked with God and was not.
Elijah, who I don't think pleased God all the time, but I think the net result of his work was probably pleasing to God.
Right. So what about these characters who were not, didn't die?
Yeah.
They were taken straight to heaven. I don't think that these two cases are problems for what I'm proposing. Because, first of all, they're not dying. There's nothing they're sacrificing, of course. There's no parallel with the death of Jesus. And I don't think there's a real parallel with the resurrection of Jesus, because for a resurrection, you have to have a death. You know, for there to be a resurrection of the body, you have to have the death of the body. And these men were not resurrected, though I think their bodies were transformed. They avoided death in some miraculous way. And I don't see that as any kind of a threat to what I'm suggesting.
Then the other side of the coin that I was going to say, and then God told the Israelites, who were
yes,
the chosen people, they were supposed to be a light unto the
Gentiles.
About them. And then he told them to go and slaughter the women, the
yeah, sure. That's right. So you're asking about what about things that the Hebrews were apparently ordained by God to do in slaughtering the Canaanites and so forth. Excellent, huge question. But let me just say this. Since it's a question about, the question is really about how that might have a bearing on what I'm proposing. I don't think it does have a direct bearing in this sense. I'm talking about one instance of evil. The suffering of an innocent man of a certain sort in a certain situation. and how that would be gratuitous but for a revelation from God as to what purpose it actually serves. Now, that might give us hope that with respect to other things that God permits, even ordains, that are puzzling to us, we would have reasons to believe he's justified. And I will conclude with that. Let me just conclude with that. If I'm right, then we are now given very good reason to think that when our own instincts tell us an evil is gratuitous, we should be careful not to trust our instincts. Because we don't always have the point of view that God has that he might give us to understand what great good was accomplished by some seemingly utterly gratuitous evil. Hey, God bless you, and may God be glorified in our bodies through the suffering we experience in fellowship with the sufferings of Jesus Christ.